Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we are cracking open a really fascinating book. It's been a bestseller for, 70 years now? The Daryl Huff's 1954 classic, How to Lie with Statistics.
Yeah, it's amazing how relevant it still is. And it's not really just a statistics primer, is it? It's more like a critical thinking manual, just sort of disguised as a stats guide.
Exactly.
Our mission here really is to arm you, the listener, with a basic toolkit, you know, for data literacy, because we're just swimming in data these days.
Totally. Big data, targeted ads, those viral charts you see everywhere.
And knowing the difference between honest information and, well, manipulation, that really hinges on understanding this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Huff wrote this, I think, because he saw that statistics, they have this aura, right? Like objective truth.
But actually, they're incredibly flexible tools for persuasion. So if you want to stop getting bamboozled by a headline or some graph that looks super impressive but is actually hiding a ton of problems,
then this deep dive is essential.
Yeah, we're learning how to spot the con, basically.
So let's talk about the guy behind it all. Daryl Huff lived 1915 to 2001. And what's interesting right off the bat is he wasn't, you know, an academic statistician, not stuck in a university somewhere.
Right. He was a journalist, a freelance writer, did a lot of popular how-to articles and things like that.
Yeah. So he wasn't inventing new statistical methods. He was just watching how the existing ones were being used.
Or misused.
Or misused, exactly. By everyone from, you know, advertisers selling soap to politicians pushing policies.
And that journalist background is key, isn't it?
Yeah.
It gave him this perspective of a skeptical outsider, like an everyday person looking at this stuff.
Definitely. He wasn't trying to write for other academics. He was performing a public service, really, translating these complicated deceptions into plain, understandable language.
And with a lot of wit, too. He really lays bare the tricks of the trade, as he calls them.
He does. He's like the ultimate watchdog in this area. Which kind of brings us neatly to his main argument, his thesis. It's wonderfully cynical, actually.
Yeah. Statistics are tools, right? And like any tool, they could be used or misused to distort the truth. And it's usually not about getting the math wrong.
No, that's the core insight. A number can be perfectly accurate, statistically sound, but the way it's framed or interpreted, that can create a completely false picture.
The old saying, figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
That's it. Exactly. It's more about rhetoric, calculated persuasion than it is about, like, arithmetic mistakes.
So the book really serves two functions. It's an expose showing you the tactics, and it's also a self-defense manual for you, the listener, the consumer, the voter, the citizen. You know, we're bombarded with this stuff constantly.
Yeah, he even coined a term for it, didn't he? Statisticulation.
That's it. Statisticulation.
Yeah.
The art of using numbers to confuse and mislead people.
And the book just takes that whole toolkit apart piece by piece. Starts with the basics, like spotting bias in who you ask.
Example, yeah.
Then looking at what average actually means, because it can mean different things. And then crucially, thinking about what's missing, the little figures that are not there.
It's like a complete blueprint for deception. We're also going to look at the visual tricks, those gee whiz graphs.
Oh, yeah, those are powerful.
And that big logical trap that gets almost everyone. Mixing up correlation with causation. Coincidence versus cause.
Okay, so let's unpack some of these. Starting right at the foundation, the sample. Chapter one is all about the sample with the built-in bias.
Right, because if your method for picking who or what you measure is skewed from the start,
then it doesn't matter how fancy your analysis is later. The conclusion is basically worthless.
Can you give us a good example? Because it sounds like something that's easy to mess up, but with huge consequences.
Oh, absolutely. The classic one, the one Huff uses, is the Literary Digest poll from 1936. Huge magazine back then. They tried to predict the U.S. presidential election, Roosevelt versus Alf Landon. And the magazine predicted a massive landslide for Landon.
Wow. Okay, and history tells us that was spectacularly wrong. FDR won, big time. So where did they go wrong? What was the bias?
Well, they got their sample names from places like phone directories and car registration lists.
Ah.
This is 1936, middle of the Great Depression. Who had phones and cars back then?
Generally wealthier people, not the average person.
Exactly. So they basically systematically left out the poor and working class voters, the very people who were strongly supporting Roosevelt. The poll was dead on arrival because the sample was just completely unrepresentative.
That's such a powerful example. And you can see how that applies today, right? Like with AI and machine learning. If your training data only comes from one group of people online,
you've got the same problem, the 1936 problem, just, you know, digitized. Your sample dictates everything.
Okay, so first hurdle, get the sample right. What's next? Huff talks about the average, right?
Yeah.
That common word that seems simple but isn't.
Yes, the well-chosen average, because average can actually mean three different things, and which one you pick tells a very different story.
It sounds so definite, the average. But it hides choices. We're talking mean, median, and mode here.
That's right. The mean is what we usually think of, add everything up, divide by the count. The median is the one smack in the middle if you line everything up. And the mode is just the one that shows up most often.
Okay, so how does the choice matter? Let's use an example, maybe like company salaries.
Perfect. Imagine a small company. Say 95 employees make $60,000 a year. Pretty typical. But then you have five executives making, let's say, $600,000 each.
Okay, big difference.
Now, if the company wants to brag, they'll advertise their average salary using the mean. Those huge executive salaries pull the mean way, way up. It sounds like a high-paying place.
Right, but that doesn't reflect what most people actually earn.
Exactly. If you want to know what the typical worker makes, you need the median. You line up all the salaries, and the middle one is still $60,000.
So choosing mean versus median completely changes the story about how generous the company is.
Completely. It's persuasion just by picking which average fits your narrative, not even lying about the numbers themselves.
Okay, that's subtle. Let's shift gears a bit. You mentioned earlier the power of omission, the little figures that are not there. What kind of things get left out?
This is huge. A claim can be technically true, but just wildly misleading because key context is missing. You need to develop a reflex, really, to ask. What aren't they telling me?
Like what? What are the big ones?
Okay, three main culprits usually. First, sample size. Mm. You see an ad. 8 out of 10 users prefer brand X. Sounds great.
Yeah.
But how many users did they ask? Was it literally 10 people? Maybe only 8? Without knowing the total number asked, that 8 out of 10 is meaningless.
Good point. Okay, what's number two?
The margin of error, especially in things like political polls. You see candidate A at 47%, candidate B at 45%. Looks like A is ahead. But if the poll has a margin of error of, say, 3 percentage points, then A could be as low as 44% and B could be as high as 48%.
So it's basically a tie.
Statistically, yes. It's a statistical tie. But leaving out that margin of error makes it look decisive. It turns a maybe into a definite.
Okay. Sample size, margin of error. What's the third one?
Definition of terms. This one's sneaky. A study says a new drug reduces heart attack risk by 50%.
Sounds amazing.
But you have to ask, reduces it compared to what? Compared to doing nothing? Compared to a placebo? Compared to another drug? And how are they even defining heart attack risk? Is it a major event or something minor? The fuzziness in the definitions. That's often where the deception hides.
Right. That lack of clarity lets them make big claims. This idea of hiding things seems to connect directly to the visual stuff too, right? The gee whiz graphs.
Oh, definitely. Our eyes are easily fooled. And the most common trick, the absolute classic, is messing with the yay axis, the vertical one.
How so?
By truncating it, they chop off the bottom part and don't start the scale at zero. So imagine a company's profits go up by, say, 5%, a small increase.
Okay.
If you start the graph axis right below the starting profit level, that little 5% bump can be made to look like a rocket launch, a huge, steep climb.
Ah, I see. It magnifies the change visually. It bypasses your logical brain and just gives you this feeling of massive growth.
Exactly. It's pure visual manipulation. But Huff points out an even sneakier one, the one-dimensional picture.
What's that?
Think about infographics. Sometimes they use little pictures, like money bags, to represent amounts. So if profits double, they might make the money bag twice as tall.
Seems reasonable.
But it's not, because when you double the height of a 2D image like that, you also double the width to keep it proportional.
Oh.
Which means the area of the money bag doesn't just double, it quadruples. 2 times taller, 2 times wider, 4 times the area.
Wow. So the picture makes the increase look way bigger than it actually is.
Way bigger, sometimes by hundreds of percent. Super common trick in visually driven media.
Okay, that's devious. All right, one more big trap Huff covers. Correlation versus causation. This feels like a really important one.
It is. It's probably the most fundamental logical error people make with data. Just because two things happen together or one after the other.
Doesn't mean the first one caused the second one.
But precisely. It's the old post hoc, ergo propter hoc fallacy.
Yeah.
After this, therefore because of this, it underlies so much bad science reporting, bad policy arguments.
What's the classic example Huff uses? The one everyone can relate to.
Ice cream sales and crime rates.
Ah, yes. Both go up in the summer.
Right. They are correlated. They move together. But obviously eating ice cream doesn't make you go out and commit crimes.
Hopefully not.
No. There's a third factor involved. The hot weather. Hot weather makes people buy more ice cream, and it makes people spend more time outside, potentially increasing opportunities for crime.
The confounding variable.
Exactly. Failing to spot that hidden third factor leads to completely wrong conclusions about cause and effect.
Such a vital distinction. Okay, let's pull back a bit and think about the big themes running through the book. What are the main takeaways?
Well, number one, I think, is that skepticism is self-defense. Huff isn't saying be cynical about everything.
Right.
But you need to be actively, intelligently critical of the numbers thrown at you. It's a survival skill in today's world.
Makes sense. What else?
Theme two is definitely the power of omission in context. We just talked about this. What's not being said, the sample size, the margin of error, the definitions, that's often the most critical piece for judging if a statistic is legit. Context is everything.
Okay. And you mentioned precision earlier.
Yeah. Theme three, the illusion of precision. You know, using lots of decimal points, like the average family has 2.53 children.
Right, which is impossible, literally.
Exactly. It gives this false sense of scientific rigor, this veneer of accuracy. But the underlying data might be messy, or based on averages that hide huge variations, or even come from a biased sample. Those decimals don't automatically mean truth.
Good point. It looks impressive, but might not be.
And the last big theme, I'd say, is how language shapes perception. We saw this with the average. Choosing the mean versus the median isn't just math, it's rhetoric. It's choosing a story to tell about wealth or income. Data presentation is never neutral, it's an act of persuasion.
Huff really had a knack for summing these things up, didn't he? With these great punchy cynical lines. Let's share a few of those. Here's one about why we fall for this stuff.
Yeah, this is good. The secret language of statistics, so appealing in a fact-minded culture, is employed to sensationalize, inflate, confuse, and oversimplify.
Oof. Yeah. We want to trust numbers, right? And that trust gets exploited.
Absolutely. And here's one about what happens when someone is determined to find a specific result in the data. If you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything.
Huh. That's brilliant. It speaks to just running analysis after analysis until you find some tiny correlation that fits what you wanted to find, even if it's meaningless in reality.
Right, which connects to another great one about whether a finding actually matters. A difference is a difference only if it makes a difference.
That's the perfect comeback, yeah. For when someone boasts about a product being like 3% more effective, does that 3% actually change anything in practice?
Probably not. It's statistically significant, maybe, but not practically important.
So all these themes, these warnings that kind of lead up to Huff's final gift to the reader, right? His practical checklist.
Yes. The five killer questions. How to talk back to a statistic. This is your defense mechanism. Every time you encounter a number that seems important or persuasive, you ask these.
Okay, what are they?
One, who says so? Who's behind this number? Do they have an agenda?
How does he know? What's the evidence? Sample, method.
What's missing? Sample size, margin of error. Definitions.
Did somebody change the subject?
Mm-hmm.
Are they using the mean when the median is more relevant, focusing on an outlier?
Does it make sense? Is this plausible? Does it align with other knowledge?
That's a fantastic toolkit. Let's try using it right now. Think about everyday situations like advertising. You see a big sign. Sale, up to 75% off.
Okay, red flags already. Question four. Did somebody change the subject? Up to 75% off likely means one or two odd items nobody wants are marked down that much.
Right.
The things you actually want are probably only 10% off. They change the subject from the typical discount to the maximum possible but rare discount.
Okay, good one. How about political claims? A politician says, under my watch, the economy grew by 4.5%.
Right. Question two, how does he know? Is that mean growth or median growth? Median might tell us more about the average family's experience.
Wow.
And question three, what's missing? What's the baseline? Did the economy crash right before they took office, making any growth look huge? Or are they comparing it to a boom time? We need that context. Cherry-picking time frames is classic.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, one more. Health news. A headline shouts, study shows drinking tea leads to longer life.
Okay, instantly question 5. Does it make sense? Is it plausible that tea causes longer life? Or question 2, how do they know? Was it just an observational study?
Meaning they just looked at people who drink tea.
Yeah. Maybe tea drinkers also happen to eat healthier, exercise more, be less stressed, or have better access to healthcare. Those are the confounding variables we talked about with correlation versus causation.
Right. So the headline changes the subject from tea drinking is associated with longer life to tea causes longer life. Big difference.
Huge difference. It's that fallacy again.
This whole process, just asking these questions relentlessly, that's the real takeaway here. For me, honestly, the thing that really hit home was the visual stuff, the gee whiz graph, and especially that one-dimensional picture trick.
Yeah.
I never really thought about how doubling the height quadruples the area, how easily our eyes can just lie to our brains about scale. It's kind of shocking.
It really is a paradigm shift, isn't it? Once you see it, you can't unsee it. The core lesson from Huff is that getting statistically literate isn't just about learning formulas. It changes you from being a passive sponge for data.
And to an active critical thinker.
Exactly. You realize numbers aren't some kind of objective truth falling from the sky. They're rhetoric. They're storytelling. And the storyteller's choices, conscious or not, shape the entire narrative you receive.
And as Huff shows us so clearly, the most effective lies aren't usually the outright fabrications. They're the truths that are just cleverly framed, selectively presented.
Which means you need that checklist. You need to keep questioning.
A skill we all need now more than ever. Keep that checklist handy.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.